Welcome to Church 307, Wyoming's online church. We are glad that you have chosen to join us today. Would you please hit the like, the subscribe, the share to get the word out to friends and enemies alike that this is happening. With that, Grant, please
hit it.
Yep. Send it.
Sweet. We're here on a beautiful Wyoming Plains day. At least some of us are. Mike.
Howdy.
How are you doing today?
Well, it is good to be with you today on this Church 307 podcast. And we have somebody very special on the podcast today. She is my sister, and her name is Gina Fellers. Thanks for joining us, Gina.
Hi, Gina.
Hello.
Gina is my older sister. She is the oldest of the five of us.
I knew you were going to start with that.
I was going to say we have Mike's younger sister joining us today.
You were going to lie. That was your goal. Yeah. Yes, there are five of us siblings, and all of us kind of went in different directions having to do with ministry, and Gina is in the education world. We're talking about a topic today that is a little bit controversial, but one that Gina knows a lot about, more than anybody else I know. We're going to be talking about education and how Christians should educate their children. Gina, could you tell us a little bit about what you do and your profession?
Okay. I currently am an assistant professor for Regent University, which is in Virginia Beach. And I teach in Masters of Education and Doctorate of Education programs, particularly in the Christian school track. So most of my students are Christian school teachers, Christian school administrators.
And you are teaching for Regent, but you live in Dallas, Texas. In fact, just over Gina's left shoulder is the Dallas skyline. She lives in like one of those apartments you see in the movies.
Oh, god dang.
Wasn't your building originally like a Sears manufacturing plant or something like that?
It was. It was kind of a distribution plant.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's, I think, 130 years old, the building. So yeah. We actually even have kind of like this train track running through the basement of our building where the trains would come through and pick up the Sears goods and take them back out again.
Yeah,
it's a pretty cool place.
Our family did Thanksgiving in her apartment building last year, and is like this. It's just, you walk through the building, you're like, this is like walking into a different world, into a movie is what it's like.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. But so Gina teaches at Regent. She is a PhD, and she wouldn't say that, but she is potentially the smartest person I know. And so we're excited today to interview her. So I would like to begin today by reading a passage we've all known and heard. It is the Great Commission passage, because I think it sets up this conversation and one that I'm predicting we're going to get to. So Matthew 28:18-20 says, Jesus came and told his disciples, and I think this beginning part is more important than what we give it credit for. I have been given all authority in heaven and on earth. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I have given you, and be sure of this: I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And so, as we talk about education, and more specifically, how should Christians educate their children? I think it's important for us to remember that the commandment or the commission that we've been given is to hand off our faith to our children. So we have been getting a bunch of hate comments on all of our social media pages, primarily our social media page that's dedicated to our kids. And every time we post something about how many kids were saved at Easter or some big kids event, there is an atheist group that gets on and just bombards our social media pages with comments about your groomers, your brainwashers, you shouldn't be forcing your faith on your children. And they hate the idea that we are handing off our faith to our kids. And so what are your thoughts about, like, what response should we give to the world who says we're brainwashing our kids by handing off our faith to our kids.
Well, that is not a new attack, not a new challenge. I've been hearing that one for decades. It's always a little amusing to me because I've been in education for 30 years, and most of the parents that I come across, most of the, you know, those who are being accused of the brainwashing, sometimes have a hard time helping their kids with algebra, and or have a hard time, you know, diagramming a sentence. Not to say that they're slow, but to say, you know, we've got complicated lives going on when we're raising our kids. And so to say we're brainwashing them, I think, is pretty amusing. And as if, you know, if you're talking about some type of hypnotic persuasion, then no, I don't think any of us have headphones on our kids where there's some chanting going on or something like that. However, if by brainwashing, we're talking about passing on, like you said, our beliefs to our kids, that's called parenting. And that is what good parents do. So yes, we are doing that. And if we don't do it, someone will.
Yeah.
If I as a parent do not pass my beliefs on to my child, if I just kind of create a cocoon for them to survive so that someone else can brainwash them, that will happen because they're going to get their beliefs from somewhere. So I as a parent have a responsibility to be the one that passes on what I believe is truth to my child. And so that's
the Disney concept of go out and discover who you are and look deep within yourself for truth. And it's all about self-discovery. You're saying, no, instead, our intention as parents is to tell them, our kids, who they are, not to allow them to discover who they are. So where's the balance there of allowing them to discover what they believe versus telling them what they believe?
And anyone who has raised a child knows you cannot command a belief to that child. You cannot command them to accept truth from you. You know, you're not, in a sense, we're pouring into them, but in a sense, we're not able to do that because they are who they are. They've been created as an individual person. What we do is tell them our story. And as we tell them our story, you know, this is where Disney comes in. Disney's very good at telling a story and helping the audience, that whoever, you know, the child who's watching this story, help them see their part in the story. You know, where could I plug myself in to that story? So, you know, that's the balance, is that we can tell them the story and then show them what their role could be in that story. And of course, we as Christians believe that we're living in a time where God actually puts the fear of the Lord in the heart of the child. God actually puts the truth in the child's heart. And so that also creates some of that balance for us, is that, yes, we're telling them the story, we're helping them understand their role. At the same time, truth has been written on the heart. So we're also drawing out of them, helping them, and we do that, I think, by helping them become aware of what it is that we see coming out of you that we believe God has put in there. You know, you are believing these things because it's been written on your heart. And so I think that's the balance. It's kind of that balance of, are we pouring in or are we drawing out?
Oh, yeah.
All right, we're doing both.
Yeah. So how much time do you spend fighting against things that they are learning outside of the home? So we have my oldest kid, Lincoln, is super into science. Like, he literally spends his free time watching these science educational videos, and they're very much from a materialistic worldview. And we allow him to watch them because they're good videos and he's interested and I want him to learn. But at the same time, all of what he's learning is very materialistic, very humanistic. And so when he was just this morning on the way to school telling me what he had learned about what animal evolved from what animal, and in this, I always have a tension. I'm not going to tell my kid whether he should believe that the world is 6,000 years old or billions of years old. But at what point do we kind of step in and say, okay, what you're learning at school, what you're learning from your teacher, what you're learning from that educational source is wrong? And when do we allow them to discover those things on their own?
I think that's a distraction. That issue is a distraction from the true issue. Because when we educate, and this is, you know, it's easier for us to do this. Parents, I think, make the mistake of thinking that education is about the content that kids are learning. So evolution, the founding of the nation, you know, these tend to be a couple of the areas where we Christians are in an uproar. We want our kids taught certain things. So we scour the textbooks, and where can we find false information that we can correct? And I really think this has been distracting us from what we really should be concerned about. It's a false issue. The purpose of education is to teach the good life. It's to teach, it's to bring about human flourishing. That's why we educate. And so we have to know two things. We have to know, one, okay, what is a human? What makes a human? What is a human? And then two, we have to know, how does the human flourish based on who the human is? How does the human flourish? And so essentially we're asking, what is the good life? And I'll take you back to the Disney example. Disney is promoting the good life, what they see as the good life. And we as Christians and Christian parents then have to educate according to what do we see the good life as being. And the good life is very different for the Christian than it is for anyone else. And when we're focused on things like what is the content that they're learning, we're not thinking about what we're really supposed to be thinking about, and that is, what is my child learning as the good life? What are they imagining? Because it is a picture. It's a picture of what's to come in your life. What do you want it to look like when you get there? And they will seek it. They will, once they get that picture of the good life, they will seek after it. And so that has to be our focus when we choose how our children are educated. We're looking for educators who will show them the same good life that we want to show them, that what they can seek after. And, you know, the good life that the gospel teaches, that scripture teaches, is foolishness and offensive to most people, to anyone who hasn't had that truth in their heart. It's foolishness. So that's what we're fighting. We're not fighting, you know, don't teach my child old earth. We're not fighting, teach my kid certain principles even of living. It's much bigger than that. It really is more of a picture of flourishing. And because in education, we develop standards, and our standards of learning start with students will be able to, and then it's either they'll be able to know something or they'll be able to do something. But much bigger than that, our students through their education are really learning what to love. They're learning what to seek. And that is something that is hard to correct later in life. You know, research shows that kids, by the time they are 5 years old, start to have this picture of what is the good life. By the time they're 12, it's pretty much solidified.
Wow.
What the life is and what they're going to be seeking for the rest of their time on earth.
Wow.
And so that makes it very serious us and makes us, it drives us to be more intentional.
So you,
what is that image that they're getting?
You look at some of those concepts that so many people spend all of their time in this conversation focusing on, like the things that are being taught, and you say that's a distraction, which I think is going to rub some people the wrong way. Right now, our library in town is in a big fight between the church and between those outside the church, primarily, who are fighting about whether or not, or what sex education books should be in the kids section or in the teen section at the library. And there's this big fight. And I've intentionally kind of stayed distant from the fight, not because I don't think it's important to have those conversations, partially because I don't fully understand the conversation, but also because I feel like it's a little bit of a distraction between what is my role as a parent in this whole scenario of watching these people fight. And I'm in a personal struggle right now trying to determine what is the best way to educate my children. So should we be homeschooling? Should we have our kids in Christian schools? And should we have our kids in public school? Of those three options, do you have like a firm, strong opinion? This is the best option. All Christians should have their kids in this type of education.
The best option is whatever educator has the same picture of the good life as you do. It's, you know, so clearly then that means you start with considering home education because you are the only one who truly sees the good life the same way you do. So you start with, is home education possible? Is that a valid option for me? And for some it is, for some it just isn't. At that point, I think you branch out and you look at, you know, there are so many different options right now. I was reading something about there's a program now. It's like they're doing it kind of Airbnb style, where you can look up online educators who have put themselves out there and said, here's what I believe, here's what I teach, here's what I'm going to do. And you can put your child in there, whether it's in their home setting, or some of these are popping up in churches, and it's kind of like a micro school setting, and a little bit like a co-op. You know, we've traditionally called them homeschool co-ops, but maybe it just gives you so many different options. So yeah, I think you start with the home and then you branch out from there. And I mean, there is no shortage of options for how can I find someone who is going to come as close as I think they can come to giving what the Bible describes as the good life. And like we said, it's very different. We find, you know, if you want to talk about what Jesus presents as the good life or what the Bible does, we look for the word blessed. Because the word blessed in the Bible really does kind of, our word for flourishing comes the closest to what they used as the word blessed. So we go back to the Sermon on the Mount, and it is backwards. It is very backwards what it is to be flourishing. You know, it's meekness, it's poor in spirit, it's mournful, it's being pure in heart and merciful. You know, this is not the good life that most people are even picturing for themselves, much less educating toward. You know, when we talk about the good life with education, typically we're talking about being prepared for college, being prepared for career, being, you know, building skills that will allow us to build wealth, or how to be healthy physically, mentally, emotionally. You know, these are the things that we're talking about when we talk about the good life, how to have good relationships. And none of these are bad, but they all should come secondarily to the good life, to the big picture of what it is. And, you know, the good life in the Bible, it's going to be more about suffering and poverty and trials and generosity and self-denial. And so it's just so counterintuitive to
you use the phrase, instead of using the phrase Christian education, you've used the phrase kingdom education. Is that kind of how does that correlate with the good life or with that upside down idea you're talking about?
Well, I'm not alone in doing that. It's that the term kingdom education, and actually I'm stepping back from it a little bit from what I used. I used to be in that camp that just kind of uses it interchangeably. A lot of times when a Christian educator will throw in the term kingdom education, they're trying to say it needs to be, because our Christian schools, you know, I just gave a picture of what the good life is according to the Bible. And a lot of our Christian schools aren't doing it. They aren't presenting this as the good life. They're actually falling more in line with college preparedness, career preparedness, and that is the good life. But, you know, we have to look at it differently. And I think that I lost my train of thought what your question was.
Yeah. What is kingdom education?
Okay. Well, kingdom education. Yep. So kingdom education it came about because people started seeing what was happening in Christian schools and saying, you're not getting it. That's not it. So we're going to talk about kingdom education and say that it's more intentional Christian, you know, getting back to what the Bible teaches and making that our foundation, instead of, you know, a lot of times Christian educators will say that we're going down the road of looking more like a so-called secular school that will plug in some verses, you know, integrate our faith into that. And so kingdom educators will say, no, we've got to flip that, and we've got to make our Christian foundation and integrate our Christianity, our foundation, and integrate the academic standards.
So rather than say, I'm going to do a school with math and English and sports, and then we're just going to pray before each of them and call it a Christian education, you're saying, no, we start with what is our goal, and then we kind of add to it those other things if necessary. Right.
And I'm wrestling with this a lot right now, because I'm even stepping back from that and saying, I'm not sure that's what kingdom education is. So I've actually stopped using the term kingdom education interchangeably with Christian education. And I'm actually developing a curriculum right now that truly defines what kingdom education is and what, you know, what separates it, what sets it apart from traditional Christian education.
Yeah, because I mean, we grew up in a Christian school. Dad ran a Christian school, and so that's kind of where you got your start in all this and how we became passionate about it. And to clarify, I have my kid in a public school, and so I'm not anti-public school. I think there's a place for all of it. We've paid close attention to who our kids' teachers are and been involved in that process, but I've honestly wrestled with it because I believe in Christian schools. However, if I'm going to look at it objectively, I look at the 16 kids I graduated high school with from this Christian school, and there is a surprising percentage, large percentage of the kids I grew up with that are no longer following God. And I think largely that's because a lot of parents said, well, I'm not doing a good job of the kingdom life in my home. So I'm going to delegate that responsibility to a Christian school. And they kind of threw their kids in a Christian school and hoped that that would make their kids Christians. And it did not work for a lot of them. So whereas I love Christian school, I do, it is not the way that we're going to do this. So what is the interaction that has to happen between parents and church and school and whatever other entity in order to ensure that we're handing off faith well?
And, you know, we particularly in Christian education know that better than anyone. We know that you can find, everyone knows somebody who put their child all the way through public school and they came out very strong in their faith. And at the same time, know someone who came all the way through Christian education and walked away, or appears to have walked away, you know, deconstructing and you know, you don't know what's really happening in the heart, but we all have those stories. And it's, you know, it's why a lot of times I'll say, this is why we read Proverbs. And, you know, we might live according to the Proverbs, but then we come back to Ecclesiastes and recognize maybe this is the real truth. And it's this idea that we as Christians seek to obey. We seek to do what we've been called to do through the Word of God. And there are no guarantees aside from eternity, aside from suffering. You know, there are a few guarantees that we have if we choose this road to go down this road of obedience. And it's not going to look a certain way. This choice has a result that looks like this. This choice has a result that looks like that. That's not what this is about. So, and I think the church is struggling. I think the church as a whole, the Christian and Christian schools are a little bit a symptom, I think, of what is happening in the church, because we're not getting a consistent message of what the good life is. And when we don't get that consistent message from our pulpits, then it makes it difficult to go against the grain as a Christian school, because a lot of our Christian schools are an extension of the church, of their local church, either, you know, internally or either at least supported by a local church. You know, there's almost always some connection. And as the church goes, Christian education seems to go. And, you know, Christian education as we know it now actually isn't that old. It's, you know, we're kind of a new thing in the scope of world history. We're kind of a new thing. And so it is still a little bit of an experiment. And I think that, you know, there right now, I think we are at a stage where many of us who are doing Christian education are doing it because it's coming out of what we see as obedience. You started with the Great Commission. A lot of us go back all the way to Deuteronomy 6, where the command is to teach these things to your children all day long, write them down and everywhere you go. And when they ask, you know, why we believe what we do, you tell them the story. Yeah. And that's what, you know, so you used the Great Commission, and I love the Great Commission. I love it because it starts with all power and authority has been given to me. I feel like we skip that part a lot of times when we read the Great Commission. We don't recognize that the reason we can do this, the reason that we can take God's word for what is the good life and walk toward that in trusting him, is because he says he does have all the power and authority. you know, if he didn't, we couldn't go out in the boldness and in the courage that we do. But because he has that power and authority, really our courage should know no end, because he's already done it. You know, it's already happening.
So I just read Tim Sledge's book, Goodbye Jesus, where he's a mega church pastor who left his faith and is no longer a Christian, calls himself an atheist or a humanist. And two big reasons that he gives for why he left his faith. It's really all about people, not much about God. But one is, getting saved doesn't actually change people. It doesn't make our lives better. It doesn't make us richer. It doesn't make us healthier. And he says the results of getting saved aren't what you would expect if God was in control. If he had all things under his authority, then you would assume being his child would make our lives better and would make us better at life. And he says he didn't see enough evidence of that. The second reason he gave is because, percentage-wise, there's not actually that many people who give their lives to Christ later in life. It's mostly just Christian kids growing up to become Christian adults. And those were his two big reasons he gave that I could see after reading his book about why he doesn't believe in God anymore. And you say to the first one, I'm assuming, he's looking for the wrong things and a result of God having all authority. Like, he's just looking for the wrong evidence.
And I think that, and I did not read all of his book, but I read enough of it to get that much out of it. And I actually have started using him in some of my examples in my courses, because we in the Christian schools, and I think because it's happening in the church a lot too, we create this moralistic culture. And a lot of time, even my students who are at the master's and the doctoral level, they come into these programs saying, the reason I want to be in Christian education is because I see how the world is behaving, and we need a place where we're teaching Christian biblical morality and ethics and character. And I tell you, my skin crawls when I hear it. And we spend the rest of the course, if we've got a new student, we spend the rest of the course kind of undoing this. Yes, once we have new life, we from that can flow, and as we're growing in that new life, from that can flow and will flow moral behavior and ethical decisions and integrity and all those character, the good character that we're seeking after. But this is not what we're about. We're about a story. We're about a story that God tells. In the beginning, God created and it was good, and then created humans and it was very good. And, you know, this is what we have to go back to. And when we establish that foundation that the story establishes, from that, the rest comes. It's why we're told to seek first the kingdom, and then the rest is added. I think that's exactly what that is about. And, you know, and if I remember right, or if I read it right, he didn't grow up in the faith. He actually came to faith, I think, more as a high schooler.
Yep.
And almost went from faith into the ministry, you know, very quickly. And I don't know that he had that solid foundation.
Yeah.
I think he went into it with the picture of the good life is the behaving is, you know, and we get so much accusation of being hypocritical. And it's because our message is a message of morality and character and ethics. And then we can't live up to that all the time. And so it's hypocritical. And what I heard him saying is that's what got him, is that for him, the good life, the picture of the good life was people behaving as, you know, behaving the way they believed, their behavior coming out of their beliefs, and that behavior is good, consistently good. And it changes us to the point where we're not capable of the thing. And he gave many examples of just, you know, the kind of stuff that you think, surely not.
Yeah.
Surely you're making that story up. No, a pastor didn't actually do that. And yet we've all heard our own stories. We've all experienced our own failures. And we know what Christians are capable of doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and I think that's one of the things that we have to do as we're presenting, educating according to the good life with our kids, is help them know the good life does not mean no more failure.
Yeah.
The good life is often characterized by failure. It is always characterized by suffering and trials. They will come. Paul said, why would you be surprised? You know, yes, the kingdom is here, but the kingdom comes through suffering and trial. Why would you be surprised? And it seems like Tim Sledge, is that?
Yep.
It seems like it surprised him.
Yeah.
The trials, the suffering, the failures, it caught him off guard.
Mm.
And he said, I tried to make sense of it and I tried to push it back, you know, thinking someday I'll understand this. And then he finally came to the conclusion, no, it doesn't make sense to me.
After reading his 99 chapter book, I left that thing not thinking, okay, you had any good arguments against Christianity. I left that thing thinking, you just left a crappy version of Christianity. He had such a legalistic, I mean, yeah, he was saved as a teenager and then he jumped, he was super intelligent. And so the church started forcing him into leadership positions because they recognized his intelligence. And they're like, you got to lead more because you're smart. Well, he just kept perpetuating this legalistic version of Christianity. I mean, most of his work was done in recovery for people with addictions, like helping them to change their behavior was his version of Christianity. And he left that version of Christianity is really what he's leaving. Not this, not the kingdom that we think of, not the idea that God changes us beyond just our behavior. Maybe the behavior is something that comes after as we are sanctified, but something else more important than our behavior changes.
Yeah, and you're right. His intelligence, I think, was part of that. I think also what I can gather, he's pretty charismatic, very gifted with the ability to lead and inspire. And, you know, it's almost the kind of thing where, and I think about when Jesus said, thank you, God, for hiding these things from the wise and the understanding and showing it to little children. And you have to start to think, okay, you know, we know that wealth can be a detriment to faith. We know that it can hinder wealth. Can intelligence be a hindrance? Can real giftedness, if you're super charismatic, and I mean, I could list a number of people who are just charismatic and yet have a hard time because of that charisma maintaining more of a steadiness about them, a consistency. You know, charisma a lot of times brings with it kind of that emotional, maybe roller coaster almost. And it kind of seemed like that's what he was experiencing.
Yeah.
And again, what we believe the good life is so counterintuitive to what he had in his head and what he was experiencing as a Christian. It was very different from his experience.
Yeah. So when I ask people if they're going to put their kid in a Christian school or not, or when I have this conversation with people, there's usually two reasons that people give. Okay, and I live in Gillette, Wyoming. In Gillette, there's three reasons. One is our school system here is awesome. Our public school system here is really good. And so the first one I usually hear is, why would I not? I know this girl that goes to my church and she would be my kid's teacher. Like, why would I not take my kid to her? The second reason I hear is, I don't know if you have a comment about this one or not, is it's just too expensive. I can't afford that, or I'm not going to pay that to put my kid in a Christian school. And then the third one that I hear, and that's more the one that I'd like you to comment on, unless you have a comment about the other two as well, but is one about evangelism. They would say, we can't pull all the Christian kids out of the public school, because then who will be there to share Christian faith with the kids at the public school? What would you say about that?
Well, the first one, I think you probably already know my answer to that one. It's, you know, can you say that educator, whoever that is going to create the right picture of the good life? So it's more about that than it is, you know, in Dallas, you know, we have some great schools and we have some awful schools. And, you know, how are you measuring that? You know, I'm assuming they're measuring it according to state scores. Usually if you're talking about what is a really good school, they're typically talking about state scores. And is that how we measure? So that's where I would go with that. The cost, I think that's hopefully changing. There are states now, there are states all the time that are starting to adopt legislation that helps, that lets the dollars follow the student. So you can actually, as a parent, use your pre-tax dollars to, and even have vouchers sometimes in some states that will let you pay for their education. The last one, yes, we have many people who will say, you know, that's a mission field. The public school is a mission field. And to that, I would say, yes, absolutely. The public school is a mission field. I am not sure it is your 7-year-old's mission field.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't say that. So I would say, if you are an adult who has been called to lead or to teach in the public school, that is your mission field. Otherwise, I'm not sure it is even your mission field. As a parent, your mission field is your child, and that child probably hasn't been given a mission field yet. We've got this answer down pat in Christian education, because we've heard the challenge so many times. And a lot of times we come back to, it took Jesus 30 years to prepare for his mission field. And yet we're excited to send our 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds into that and say, be missionaries. And I've seen God do it. I've seen God use kids as missionaries in public schools in all kinds of settings. So I am not saying he can't do it, but I'm saying take a step back on that and ask, is that public school my 7-year-old's mission field?
Yeah. And that's something we've wrestled with in our house a lot. And that's why we've paid close attention to the teachers our kids, Lincoln has had. I would say one of the most emotional moments I had of last year was a day that Lincoln came home and he said, I told so-and-so at school about Jesus. And he one of his friends that, he wanted to share his faith with, he had told us multiple times that he wanted to tell him about Jesus. And finally, at the end of the school year, last day of school, he tells his friend about Jesus. And I'm overwhelmed with emotion in this moment, because I'm proud of my son for having that kind of faith and caring about that and recognizing that that is important. But then also emotional about the burden that he had to carry, in addition to all the 7-year-old burdens that you have to carry into school every day and figuring out popularity and kids, and their kids are mean, and trying to figure out life. In addition to this burden of, I've got to share my faith with this kid because I feel like God is asking me to. In addition to that, he had an interaction with a kid who was making fun of him for being a Christian. And I'm not. The reality is, though, I look at this and I see, I remember that kind of stuff happening to me when I was in Christian school. So it's not like we're talking black and white differences here. there's a lot of gray in between these conversations. But yeah, life is a heavy burden, and we have to consider what burdens are we going to allow our kids to carry and which ones aren't we going to have them carry.
And those situations, I remember stories from when my children were little and in Christian schools, and I remember those situations happening in the neighborhood, just playing with the neighborhood friends. And I mean, that is a spirit that, and you're making me miss Lincoln, that is a spirit that Lincoln has inside of him that's going to be hopefully ready, throughout his life. And I think Lincoln has a particularly strong background in this and does have an advantage probably.
Yeah, absolutely. And he has his grandparents living with him and his parents living with him in a great church. And we are here every Sunday. It is a priority. So he is getting education outside of the school. I've heard you talk before about a three-legged stool of church and family and school and how those three combined can help build a strong foundation. And so I think that's important. And we wrestle daily with the education side of that one. So that's helpful. Yeah, thank you for that.
That illustration is I believe Glenn Schultz illustration. And he actually was writing about kingdom education, and he was kind of saying kingdom education is the obedience factor when it comes to that three-legged stool, when you have all three working together. And if you lose one of them, then your stool doesn't stand. So that goes back to him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks so much for this. And thanks for sharing your expertise on the Christian education front. I think you're an expert in two things, Christian education and my childhood.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed that we didn't get to open with that because maybe I'll get to come back. I mean, sharing some Michael memories.
Oh, we want those. We need those. We crave. We want that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was cursed with a bad memory and I don't remember my childhood. So you could tell any story that you would like to share about my childhood and people would just have to believe it. I don't know. You could just make it up.
Oh, I wouldn't have to make anything up. No, I didn't even embellish.
Right.
I could just give facts.
The facts are good enough, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a perfectly well-behaved child who never did anything wrong. That is the reality of my childhood.
I mean, the most famous story, the one that gets repeated at pretty much every family gathering would say that's not so, the biting incident, I think.
Biter?
Who did I bite? Did I bite you or Rebecca?
It was Beck. You bit Beck and then refused to apologize.
Something's never changed.
You were showing your stubborn side even way back then. And I think it ended up being, I don't know, we have all of us remembered a little bit differently how long it took. It was at least an hour and a half of begging you to apologize because the family could not move on with what we were doing until you would apologize, and you would not do it. And when you finally did, it wasn't out of a changed heart. We finally, the three of
it was
us,
was out of a sore butt.
I didn't know if I could say that or not.
Yeah.
But yes, it was that. But the three of us got together and thought, how could we trick him into it? So one of us said, Michael, what is it that you're supposed to say? And you finally said, I'm supposed to say I'm sorry. And that was, we took it and it was over.
I was brainwashed as a kid, I'll tell you that. No, that's good. So our family scenario is three old people and two younger people, and I'm in the younger people scenario. So I was brainwashed by old people, old brother and sisters, and parents.
You had a ton of education.
I was
educated by parents and older siblings and
lots of parents, for
lots
sure.
Lots of parents, okay.
And he turned out pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
Still stubborn.
Most recently, I'm most grateful for his leadership for our Israel trip was, I mean, I got to watch my little brother that whole trip and think, okay, if this is where all that was headed, it was a good thing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Gina. Thanks for taking time out. And we hope to have you on again very soon to talk about another one of the areas that you are an expert in.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's an honor. Bye.
And with that, that was a great interview. I love pointing it back to Good Life.
Yeah.
Man, that was a great interview.
Yep, absolutely. And as you go, know that Jesus loves you unconditionally, and he died to give you new life.